Welcome to Butterflies of Wisdom, everyone. Today I have an amazing guest who just told me before we got on this call that he has published 9 books. Beat me. I'm at 6 and working on 7 and 8, but beat me. And gave a law degree to publish books, I guess. And so, without further ado, I'm going to just take it away.
Hey, Wynn. Namaste.
Namaste to you, too. And for those of my listeners who may want to know the Curiosity Kills Cat question, why did you give up such a stable income in law to publish books?
Well, a couple reasons. Law is a profession that really can weigh on your soul. You don't necessarily have to do things that are immoral, but they're the pressure to win, the pressure to get for your client whatever your client wants, whether you think that's right or wrong, is always there. And so there's what I call an icky factor to being a lawyer that was always uncomfortable for me. So I was sort of looking for a way out of law almost from the time I started. And luckily, my career was very successful, and so I was able financially not to need the income by the time I was in my 50s. So I left the law and have been able to pursue spending my time in ways that I find more helpful to the community. And so I write and I teach and I lead Himalayan trekking and mountaineering expeditions. And I serve on several nonprofit boards.
So, okay, you lead Himalayan nonprofit trekking. How is that possible? How is that possible?
Well, it's possible because when I turned 40, my wife diagnosed me as having a midlife crisis. And one day when I came home from the office, she slapped a brochure about trekking in the Himalayas down in front of me and told me that I should go do this. So she was basically saying, go take a hike on the other side of the world. And so I did, and I fell in love with the Himalayas and the people and the culture that inhabit the high mountain regions in Nepal and India. And so I just kept going back and eventually started a foundation to help remote villages, because in Nepal and India are very poor countries. They're the poorest countries outside of some in Africa. And so there's a great need for improved schools, medical, water systems, electricity. And so I've worked on projects in this one particular remote area on all of those infrastructure systems. And the foundation has been going since 2008. And just this year, it is finally well-developed enough that I was able to resign as president, but I'm still on the board. And so it's one of those things I feel is really one of my great achievements. And it's called the Bassa Village Foundation. And unfortunately, last year, there were terrible earthquakes in Nepal. So this year, all of our efforts have been focused on raising money for earthquake relief funds to rebuild the Bassa Village area.
How cool is that? Well, without further ado, I'm going to throw it over to my co-host, Juan Carlos Gil, Jeff, so he can ask you more brilliant, profit questions about you, your foundation, and what you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you want more information about the foundation?
My name is Juan Carlos Gil, and I would love to ask you some more questions about what you do in your foundation, and especially because you do stuff in Nepal that is really amazing. About 10 years ago, there was a guy named Eric Weinmeier. I don't know if you were around and you were doing stuff with your foundation or around that time. And this gentleman was the first blind alpinist that climbed Mount Everest. He's part of the National Federation of the Blind. And did you know anything about that or no?
I don't know him, but I actually have read about his climb. I have a cousin who's blind and has gone to Nepal with me, and she's done trekking, and she's very active in a service dog organization. In fact, she's the president of it in California now, so I'm, kind of familiar with that.
I see. Okay. I think I know who you're talking about because, yeah, California does have a great program for guide dogs and stuff like that. My question
her name
is the following. Uh-huh.
Sorry, go ahead. Her name is Melissa Hudson.
Yes. With Ms. Hudson and with your understanding of people with low vision and stuff like that, my question is then, do you feel that people could eventually start doing trekking and not only being visually impaired but also physically impaired? For
yeah,
example,
I do.
Wheelchairs?
At this point, on most of the high mountain trails, a wheelchair would probably be impossible because the trails were actually made for yaks. For hundreds of years, everything in the Himalayas has moved on the back of yaks or on the back of human porters. And so the trails are very rocky. There has been some effort in both Nepal and India to improve some of the lower trails. And when I say lower, I mean trails between 5,000 and 8,000, 9,000 feet. And so there are some trails now that would be probably wheelchair accessible with some assistance. But at this point, the higher mountain trails, like the trail to Mount Everest Base Camp, I think would just be too rugged. There are certain sections of the trail where it's just like stone steps. You're just stepping from one boulder to another. But I think visually impaired people absolutely can do trekking. And I've, my cousin Melissa has done some trekking in Nepal, and I've seen other visually impaired people on the Mount Everest Base Camp Trail.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, with your foundation, especially because you're trying to get running water and you're trying to get so much infrastructure in Nepal, what do you feel, because of all, of all people, I think that this could definitely a benefit or hinder your foundation that you started. The whole getting a worldwide access to you know, to pure drinking water that Coca-Cola is trying to do. What's your feeling about that?
Well, I think any effort to bring safe water to remote regions, so long as it's effective, I'm all for it. I mean, I don't care who sponsors it. I would be delighted if foundations like mine cease to exist because the need was no longer there. And I think someday that will occur, but at this point, there are still many villages in the Himalayas where there is no running water, and people are still getting their water by walking to the nearest stream or river with buckets. And, you know, that's how the village I worked with, Basa Village, all of the villagers would walk to a nearby stream, which was about a 20 or 30 minute walk down a very rough mountainous ridge, with their buckets, and that would be the water for the day. Now they have spigots. They don't have interior water, but they have spigots to each of their homes, so they still use buckets, but at least they don't have to risk turning an ankle carrying heavy water buckets up and down a mountainside.
No, definitely, I understand. Now, have you had the opportunity? You said that you researched Eric Weinmeier. I don't know if you know this or not, but do you know that he has his own non-for-profit organization called the? Oh my God, what's this organization again? It is a. Oh my God, it eludes me right now, but I'll get back to that in 2 seconds. That's the first time this ever happens to me. But have you ever thought about maybe...
It'll happen more often as you get older, believe me.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Especially because I have CP, it happens quite a bit, and it scares me. Have you thought about starting, your own non-for-profit or maybe getting close to, being a co-founder of a non-for-profit that just does that, maybe does trekking and sports for people with disabilities or people that are blind, especially because your cousin that's the director of the guide dog school in California?
No, I really haven't thought of that. I mean, the trekking that we do is just, it's there for anybody, and anybody who's ever wanted to either form a group or join one of the groups that we're sponsoring is welcome. And we've never turned anybody away, no matter what their condition or situation is. But the foundation has been devoted to helping the villagers in Nepal. So it's not intended to be for the benefit of Americans or Westerners. I think that would be a very worthy thing, project for somebody to undertake. And I think somebody like my cousin being involved, she'd be a natural if she had the time to do it. She's on the board of the Basa Village Foundation as well. So she's a pretty busy woman, but that's certainly something that I suspect would interest her.
Interesting. Wow. Now, reading your bio, it's so profound. Going back to you becoming a lawyer, and I really... I really want to focus on your aspect as being a lawyer because it's, I have some questions, and I'm guessing the listeners might have these questions at one point or another too. Why is it such a big, like, you know, why do lawyers get so big of a chunk when you're trying to do lawsuits or you're trying to do any type of, you know, monetary value of, you know, of you trying to help a client? For example, when somebody's trying to sue a hospital because of malpractice, the lawyer gets 50% or 40% of all the winnings. And why is that?
Because lawyers control the system. The medical system it's not so much anymore controlled by doctors because administrators and insurance companies have taken over the medical system and actually reduced what doctors get paid. But the legal system is still controlled by lawyers. And so lawyers limit the market in terms of who can become a lawyer. And so because there are only so many lawyers, we can set our prices. And if you want to hire a lawyer, you're going to have to pay what they charge. And even though there have been some antitrust suits years ago about fee setting, the reality is within different communities, everybody knows what the minimum charges are for different types of lawsuits and legal services, and the best charges or the best lawyers charge at the high end of the range, and the less experienced, less well-known lawyers charge at the low end of the range. But there's a range, and if you want to hire a lawyer, that's what you're going to have to pay. So it's a matter of economics in terms of control. If you control the system, you control what it's going to cost.
No, definitely. You're absolutely right about that. And that's here in the States. How about in other parts of the world, Colombia, Nepal? I'm like, what happens? I'm like, what is the normal going rate for lawyers? Is it really minimal wage, or is it like same thing like here in the States? How does that work?
Yeah, it's different in every country. The States is the most expensive. Other countries, lawyers tend to charge lower fees. And it's not necessarily that there are more lawyers per capita. I'll tell you, though, one advantage of the American legal system over almost every other in the world is it actually operates pretty fairly in the sense that bribes are not paid, whereas in most other countries, you have to bribe your way through a system. When I visited India for the first time years ago, I met with some lawyers and judges just out of curiosity to sort of make my own study of the Indian legal system. And what I learned was it could take up to 7 years for a lawsuit to process all the way through, and the claimants would have to pay a bribe at every level. So to file your suit, you pay a bribe. To have a preliminary hearing, you pay another bribe, and so on and so on. And with a rare exception, that doesn't happen in our system. On the other hand, I suppose you could say, well, but because lawyers in the U.S. are so expensive, it might be cheaper to have less expensive lawyers and pay bribes to the clerks and bailiffs and judges along the way. You can Google, questions like what are legal fees in, and pick out a country, and you'll see that comparatively the U.S. is at the top in terms of most expensive.
Fair enough. Last question, and I'll bring it back to Wynn. And it's actually Eric Weinmeier, actually, his company is called No Barriers. So have you ever thought about going to No Barriers and maybe talk about what you do with Nepal and the, you know, in doing the alpine and also doing trekking?
Well, I've never made that personal connection, and really the only thing I know about him is having read about, you know, his climb of Everest a few years ago. So, I would be happy to get connected with him, but I've never sought him out, and he hasn't sought me out.
I understand. But before one comes in, at least for right now, my question is, I know we have the United Nations. The United Nations governs the world as far as peacekeeping and a lot of different things. That is great. But why hasn't the United Nations created a coalition or an organization to promote equality, a global equality and global accessibility for people with disabilities? So there's a, you know, there's one, so every country in the world has governed rules that they have to abide by for accessibility, because you have some that are accessible, you have some countries that are not that accessible. You even have here in the United States where even though that we have the ADA, it hasn't, it really has not been fulfilled to 100% of its standards. You have some places in Colombia that are more accessible than here in the States as far as hotels and all that stuff. So why isn't there a standard?
Well, I guess I would think it's for the reason that every sort of civil rights and human rights movement is at a particular stage of development. And the human civil rights movement for people with disabilities, you know, hasn't progressed that far. So the only way it's going to happen is for people to create political pressure on organizations, on, you know, on governments, on the UN. If people think that leaders of these organizations are going to just do that, you know, make those sorts of rules, regulations, legislation out of the goodness of their heart or concern, well, progress is going to be pretty damn slow. You want to increase the speed of progress, you got to build coalitions to create political pressure. That's how change comes about.
Okay, perfect. I see. Thank you so very much, Wynn. I'll bring it back to you. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
And, Jeff, I want to know more about your books and have these treks in Nepal inspired your books, or what's the inspiration behind your books?
Well, the first book of mine that was published was 100% inspired by my experiences in Nepal, and the focus of the book is to describe how I got connected with Bassa Village. And so that story is in the book. The sort of the main theme of the book is how to combine doing something that you love, like for me, trekking, with also giving back or giving to others. And so I coined the phrase philanthro-trekking, meaning, you know, a combination of philanthropy and trekking. But it's not just limited to that. But the sort of the lesson that the story offers to readers is that, you know, there are so many communities and people that could use the help of those who are blessed and privileged, like so many of us are here in the U.S. But you don't have to be a martyr and, you know, give up everything and, you know, wear a loincloth and give away all your material possessions. You can find ways to give that combine or connect with doing something you really enjoy. So what I did is whenever I would organize a trekking or mountaineering expedition, I would also connect it with a fundraising event. And so the main benefit that the book describes was to build an addition to this little village school. The school had three grades, and they wanted to add a fourth and a fifth grade. So I went about raising the money to buy the materials to build the addition and to hire a fourth and a fifth grade teacher. And then several of us who were involved in the fundraising trekked to Bassa Village. So anyway, that's kind of the lesson that I was trying to promote, is find ways to connect doing things you really enjoy with philanthropy.
And what's the title of your book?
That book is entitled Bringing Progress to Paradise.
Bringing Progress to Paradise. And is it on audio tape or is it on Amazon Kindle?
It's on Kindle and in print. It hasn't been made into an audio book.
Would you ever consider that?
Well, as a matter of fact, the publisher and I, several years ago, discussed turning it into an audio book, and we even got so far as modifying the contract, the literary contract we had, to go forward with that, but for various reasons it hasn't happened. Two of my books are on audio, as well as print and e-books, and they're the two fiction books I've written. Most, seven of the nine books I've written are nonfiction. The only two that have been made into audiobooks are the two fiction, which are historical novels.
And what are their titles?
One is entitled False Prophet, and it's in the genre of legal thriller. It's based on a case I had. And then the other one is entitled Monsters of the Midway, and it's based on the actual experience I had of playing on the worst college football team, which is kind of, it's sort of a comedy, but it's also involves a historical narrative about the history of football in America, and then it fictionalizes my own experience of playing on this team that People magazine called the worst team in college ball.
Oh, my God. How funny is that? And were you doing it to have comic relief from your day job, or were you so into writing now that you didn't need comic relief from your day job?
Well, I have always written, and I started having articles. Actually, the first thing I ever had published was some poetry when I was in college, and it really wasn't very good poetry. But I've just always been a writer on the side, you know, as a student and then as a lawyer. And so I started writing feature articles, and eventually I had a I had two books that I wanted to write. One was based on that this case that turned into the book False Prophet, because it was just this amazing series of events that there was a political conspiracy involved in trying to prevent an inner-city African-American preacher from taking over certain land he had acquired, because these real estate speculators wanted the land. And so, it's this sort of complicated conspiracy between real estate speculators and local government politicians, basically trying to screw this poor inner city minister who had this vision of creating a church and a youth center and so forth. And so I fictionalized that case to tell that story. And then the other book, I wrote The False Prophet first, but I didn't find a publisher for it for several years. And in the meantime, I wrote about Bassa Village, Bringing Progress to Paradise, and immediately found a publisher for it. So it got published back in 2009, I think it was, and then False Prophet came out a year or so later.
Well, man, that's interesting that your original book got published after your Treks to Nepal book, because Treks to Nepal fascinates people. Lawyers' cases do not. I have come to discover that lawyers in books do not necessarily fascinate people. And that being said, I'm going to throw it back over to my co-host, Juan Carlos Gil, so he can ask you more questions about publishing books and writing process, and then we together will tie up the show.
All right.
Perfect. Thank you. And curiosity, now that you're talking about trekking in Nepal and you were writing a book, one is, there was recently a movie called Everest. Was your books and trekking creating around Everest to promote in Nepal, or what was the movie created for, or was it for awareness of Mount Everest and the danger, that people, have climbing Mount Everest? That's one question. And the second question is, what do you think about having the National Library of Congress actually convert your books for free so individuals that are print disabled could have equal access to your books like everybody that's able to read without no problem?
Well, I have to admit, question number two, I have not thought about that. I like the idea. I mean, in my case as a writer, I'm somewhat unique in the sense that I've never written books just for the money. I mean, I made my living as a lawyer, and so I wrote for the joy of it. And I wrote because I had a story I wanted to tell, or I had a point I wanted to make, or a lesson to teach. And so for me, the greatest gratification is just knowing that people have read my books. I mean, it's lovely to get a royalty check. So for me, I think that I'd be delighted if that happened. For writers who really are dependent on royalties for their living, I'm not sure that's really fair to them. I mean, you've worked to write this book, and you're expecting to make money off it because that's your art, that's your trade, that's your profession. So to, if no, you know, if nobody's going to pay for it, it's not going to work.
Amen.
You're absolutely right, but at the same time, you're in one of these categories that you're able to give your work for free, and that's great and very, you know, and that's amazing. But don't you feel, especially because you have a family member that is blind, don't you feel that it will be, that is equally fair for somebody that's totally blind to have a book in Braille so they can read it, or have a book in audio content so they could listen to it, or somebody that has cerebral palsy could enjoy the books, like, let's say, that you have, or the books from Dom Brown, or books from Mount Everest, or books of whatever have you not? Because in the, you know, there's what? There's 200,000 books, 300,000 books, and out of those 300,000 books, I think it's 50,000 books have been converted to accessible media. And now that you talk about, maybe it's because it's, you know, the National Library Service is not paying the authors. But I'm like, do you think that there has to be a give and take? Curiosity.
Well, yeah, I think there should be give and take. And I don't think it should be all on one side. I think that an author has a right an expectation to be paid for the work that he or she has done. Now, who's going to pay for that in order to convert a book into audio or Braille is a question for the government and the market to answer. I mean, I would, like I said, you know, every author wants their books to be read, and so I think every author would be delighted to have their books in audio and Braille, but the authors that are depending on royalties for their books are not going to be very happy if what that means is those books are just given away, and I don't see why they should be. I mean, you know, somebody should pay for the work that the author has done. So the question then would become, who should be responsible for it? And if a person with impaired vision can afford to pay for it, they should pay for it, just like anybody else. I mean, I don't think that having an impairment entitles someone to just be given something simply for the fact that they have an impairment. Having an impairment, the obligation of society is to make reasonable accommodation. And so reasonable accommodation doesn't mean you get something for free if you can afford it. On the other hand, having a service available for people with sight impairment who can't afford to buy the books would be a wonderful thing, a good thing. And yeah, I think that that's a function that either private organizations, libraries, or the government ought to do.
Okay, I see. Now, the National Library Service has been around since the 1950s. I get what you're saying, and you're absolutely right, but don't you feel that if, let's say, you know, I'm just going to throw this out there. If it's true, it's true. If it's not true, you know, it's close enough. Let's say, for example, J.K. Rowling, the author of Harry Potter, okay? J.K. Rowling made millions upon millions of dollars on Harry Potter. She created movies. She created books. Now, she could have easily said, no, let me let me charge the National Library Service $2 million for my books to be converted, for a man to actually convert the books, or a woman to convert the books and have it read out loud for somebody that's totally blind or print disabled, because print disabled means that they cannot physically turn a page. And, you know, pretty much charge that service so then you could actually, so then let's say 10,000 people that are blind in the United States alone, or worldwide 100,000 people, and could actually enjoy J.K. Rowling's books. I don't know if you know this, but the majority of individuals that are blind, the best book out there has been J.K. Rowling and several other books just because of the availability. Same thing with Don Brown. I'm like, he's a great author. Same thing with the Splinter Cell series, stuff like that. There's a lot of murder mystery books. There's a lot of law books that has been converted. So what could authors and publishers and publishing houses create to have that fundamental right where blind and print disabled people could have the same equal access as their, you know, able-bodied individuals? Because most of the individuals that are print disabled are in fixed income. And it's not like you could easily say, okay, yeah, let me go to Audible and let me give Audible $20 a month to just download one book. I'm like, that's not going to work. If it could be an a la carte thing, like what audiobooks.com did at one point, and then they took that away, that's a different story. But people that are in fixed income, they only get $700 and something a month to live, and that's it. People love to listen to books, but they're not working. So where would you go with that curiosity?
Well, so the problem seems to be, okay, so if there's a library within the community, if a library is reachable, at least every library that I'm aware of stocks audiobooks now. And so those would, whatever stock of audiobooks a library has would be available to print impaired people. And then it's just a matter of, you know, making the connection between that person and the library. But the problem would be, I guess, that there just aren't enough of those books being made available through free library lending. And which I'm not, I mean, that problem should not be hard to solve, because in terms of buying through Amazon, that's a problem that would be very difficult to solve. Because first of all, you have an author with a literary contract with a publisher. The publisher is in the business to make profit. The author is in the business to make a royalty. So to convince both publisher and author that they should give their work away for free is going to be a difficult thing to do. However, most every book goes to a library, and publishers give their books to the library. So why not? Why wouldn't the publishers that create audiobooks be giving all of their audiobooks to libraries? I mean, that seems to me to be the solution, and I think it's working in part now. Right? I mean, aren't you, whatever library you use, doesn't it make available audiobooks at no charge?
Correct, yes. But the audiobooks that we're talking about, you're talking about, let's say, commercial-related books, books that you could buy commercially. I'm talking about the National Library Service, for example. Commercial-related books that, let's say, back in the days when you could get in cassette, people had to pay for those books. Most of those books were already converted for the blind. For example, the National Library Service has big, huge, tremendous big warehouse, especially now that's all digital. They have 100,000 books, 200,000 books, if not more, and sometimes they make copies. One book could be copied 9 times. So imagine the amount of books they actually have in these warehouses for people that are blind or print disabled to read. But let's say your books that are very, very inspirational and you could easily charge an Amazon $30 a book because it's that good. Somebody that's print disabled would really want to read that book, but they're just not going to be able to afford $30. I'm like, some people, and I'm being realistic here, some people decide not to go to the movies because they do not have the funds to go to the movies. Instead, they have to wait it out and maybe watch it on Netflix because they're getting the Netflix from somebody else, or not watch movies at all and just buy food and just live, because there's some people in the real world that are in fixed income that they just live on whatever the federal government gives them, and that's it. That's their only income. And that's what
I'm very well aware of that. My father is print impaired, and he lives on a fixed income. And the only way he's able to enjoy even his son's own books anymore is through audiobooks. He can't read. And so I'm very familiar with the situation. And it seems to me that, though, if almost every book that's published, a paperback copy or a hardback copy or now ebook copies are going to libraries. And so the same should be done with audiobooks. Now, of course, there are a fair number of books that are being published that just are not turned into audiobooks. I mean, like I said, I've had 9 books published, only 2 of them are in audio. And the reason is it's more expensive. You have to hire a narrator. And narrators are either going to take get paid as much of a royalty from the audiobook as the author is, or the narrator is going to be paid an hourly rate, which it's not as expensive as a lawyer, but it's not inexpensive. And so I suppose maybe that's the commercial, financial problem the publishers would have in giving the audiobook to libraries. But, they've given print books, they've given e-books for decades. So it seems to me the next step is publishers, just every audiobook that's made, give a few copies to every library, and there you go.
Perfect. Sounds good. Thank you so much. And with that being said, I'm going to be bringing Wynn back in.
Okay.
And just to let you know, Jeff, there is a site called acx.com, which Audible runs, and then you put your book up on ACX, you record it or find a narrator, and then they charge their fee to have people buy the books. So that's a good prospect there. And then you can also get a 1-month trial off of Audible.com, you guys. For those of you who are fascinated by this conversation, you guys can also get a 1-month trial off Audible using the promo code Healthy, Wealthy, and Smart, which is another podcast run by Karen Litzy, a PT out of New York. So there's another option, you guys. And, Jeff, what is your favorite podcast?
Well, it's this one now, if I'm going to be honest.
Oh, you're being nice. You're being nice to me. No, I thought you were going to say something along the lines of mountaineering, but you're being nice. And what is your favorite TED Talk, if you have one?
Well, I out of pure humility, I should say my own, because I gave one a few years ago. But one that I heard a number of years ago and that I actually quoted from in my second-to-last book was by a guy named Michael Shermer, and he's the publisher of Skeptic Magazine. And I found it really fascinating, and what his TED Talk was about is beliefs and why is it that human beings believe anything? You know, why don't we just operate based on evidence and, you know, make decisions based on the best evidence available? Why do we need beliefs? I mean, why do we need to believe in God? Why do gamblers need to believe they'll win? Why do entrepreneurs need to believe their businesses will succeed? And it all goes back, according to Michael Shermer in this TED Talk, to evolution, and that it's a survival mechanism. And the example he gives is, if you're walking along through a grassy forest and you're, we'll just say, you know, a caveman, an ancient Homo sapien, and you hear a rustle in the grass, if you believe that that could be a dangerous snake, even if it's not, you're more likely to survive than someone who doesn't believe that and either ignores it or has to inspect and investigate, and then in the course of the inspection or investigation gets bit. And so the ancient Homo sapiens that survived were ones who carried these beliefs in their minds, in their psyches, and then that just expanded over time into this vast array of things that people believe in. And anyway, I found that kind of fascinating. And the title of the book that I wrote that used that is Godless, Living a Valuable Life Beyond Beliefs. And the theme of that book is that we've gotten to a point where believing in religious and political ideologies is detrimental to community and is actually subverting positive human relations rather than promoting them.
And Jeff, where can people find you and your fascinating projects, including your works of writing?
Well, I have a website, and it's my name, jefffreyrasley.com, and there's an author page in Amazon with my name, and or if you Google my name, you'll find my website and my books and connections with the Bassa Foundation. So
does the Bassa Foundation have a separate website, or is it connected to yours? Obviously, it's probably connected to yours.
Well, it's connected to mine, but it has its own website. Yeah, it's a 501c3 nonprofit, and yeah, it's got its own website, which is bassafoundation.org.
So your website is bossafoundation.com.org, even though it's connected to you.
Well, the official website of the foundation is bassafoundation.org, and it's linked to my website. Just, I mean, we have a shared link, and my website
Now I understand. So your link is on your website. And with that being said, I'm going to let Juan Carlos Gil close the show out. And it was lovely talking to you, Jeff. And I hope my crew of Butterflies of Wisdom follows your journey.
Oh, well, thank you, Wynn. It's been delightful talking to you, and I hope we'll do it again someday.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Wynn. A curiosity, do you have a YouTube channel that you have created videos about your trekking experiences and stuff like that?
Yeah, on my website, there's a link to different expeditions that I've led, and it references, and also there's a link to the Nepal trekking company that I work with, which is called Adventure Geo Treks. And so if you Google Adventure Geo Treks, or if you go to my website and click on the link that says prior expeditions, then that opens up picture galleries and a couple videos about the trekking expeditions and mountaineering expeditions that I've done with Adventure Geo Treks.
I'm gonna put this out there, and I'm serious, but I'm kidding at the same time. If this is really something cool, I definitely would love to take at least 10% out of whatever it's going to make. But have you ever thought about, especially now that social media is such a big boom with Facebook Live and YouTube Live and all this stuff, have you ever thought about actually live streaming one of your treks or one of your adventure geo treks into Nepal?
Well, yeah, actually, the foundation is planning on sponsoring a trek and mountaineering expedition in October next year, so October 2017. And the current president of the foundation, who succeeded me, a guy named Joel Myers, is planning on making a documentary film about it. As far as live streaming, I don't think so, but he's made videos from previous treks that he's been on, and so I'm not a techie sort of person. I use a point-and-click digital camera, and I've actually had a number of my photos published, but that's mostly just sort of basic, you know, framing. I've never taken a course in photography. I don't even take videos. So that's Joel's department, but he's definitely planning on trying to create a documentary film about what the foundation has done, and then including our upcoming attempt to climb this mountain called Mira Peak, which is kind of just off the Everest Base Camp Trail.
Wow, that's very, very cool. Now, the last question is, have you ever said, let me donate my time, my wisdom to upcoming lawyers and upcoming individuals that want to maybe supersede me and have a passion for non-for-profit work and create a non-for-profit that, you know, that brings together everything that you do and then some?
Well, when I was practicing law, I was very active in pro bono work I was on our local bar association's pro bono committee and the federal court pro bono panel, and I did pro bono work with the juvenile court as well. But since I've left law, that's up to the next generation of lawyers, and I'm devoting my time on not-for-profits that really don't have anything to do with law. But there's, you know, there's in every city of any size, there are hundreds of lawyers, many of whom have good hearts and great experience, and it's just a matter of carving out the time to do that sort of thing.
I see. So before we go, what would you like to end the show with in a very high note? What would that be?
Well, blessings to any of your listeners who found this time worthwhile, and appreciation to you, Juan, for your incisive questions. And I hope you have gotten something out of it, and I hope others will listen and maybe be inspired to find their own version of philanthro-trekking, to combine activities and experiences that they have passion for with
Kennedy, are you there?
Others. Uh-huh.
Perfect, perfect. I will do that. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Do not hang up. Let me end the call. Let me just end the recording 1 second. Okay, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And the call just got ended, or the recording that got ended. Okay. Now, with that being said, tell me something. This is off the record. What do you feel about – I have several questions, two or three questions about legal questions, if you don't mind me asking. I recently got my equipment stolen. I am a photographer, videographer as well. I saw that, and I was going to ask you about photography, and I totally forgot. I'm a photographer, videographer, and I have my live streaming equipment. I was giving my time for a non-for-profit. This is called the Sabrina Cohen Foundation. We were at the beach, and there was about maybe 60 individuals with disabilities plus their families. I got interviewed by Channel 7 News, and hold and behold, my equipment walked up and left. Somebody stole my equipment. Sabrina Cohen created a GoFundMe campaign. Thank God it was not my main equipment. It was just my, my streaming equipment, but still it was about $2,000. So based on that, we've raised a little bit over $1,250 in the GoFundMe campaign, but it's right now, it's stopped. It's not moving. How could you recommend me to create such a thing where I could open people's hearts so people could just help me with this so I could continue what I do? Because what I do is that I want to showcase the message of so many organizations, like let's say the National Federation of the Blind or Sabrina Cohen Foundation, to showcase what they do to, you know, for individuals with disabilities.
Well, I think GoFundMe is the way to go. And so we used GoFundMe on our last fundraiser for Basa Village for the earthquake relief, and we had really good success with it. So you have your GoFundMe account, you create a website link to the account, you do an email campaign, you know, email everybody whose address you have, And then, you know, it's just, it's social media, you know, you post about it, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the social media outlets that you're involved with or get involved with them, and, you know, that's it. That's what we did, and, of course, we have 30-some members, so we had 30-some people doing that, as opposed to just one person. But when I started, that's what I did with just me. And, you know, that's it. That's the way it's done nowadays.
No, I know. It's difficult. It's difficult, but definitely, I don't know if you have contacts of your own that maybe you could share my link or something to see if you, if with your foundation or your contacts, you guys could help me, because I would truly appreciate it. Because at this point in time, I don't know what to do. I'm stuck. I am like, I haven't gone crazy. I don't know how, because I think I'm just trying to say it, to have high hopes. But yeah, it's difficult. What this showed me was that the people that you really thought that had your back, they don't have your back at all. People are just, they're great when, you know, when they could use you, but when they can't use you, they don't care for you. That's what I've learned about all this since almost a month ago that they stole my equipment.
Well, I don't know about that. My cousin, Melissa Hudson, I think might be interested in helping. And so, you know, you can send me the GoFundMe link and information, and I'll certainly be glad to pass it on to her. And if she gets excited by it, you know, she's, like I said, a real significant force and leader in the blind community in all of California.
I will do that, and thank you so very much for that. I truly appreciate that. Now, talk to me about your experiences as a photographer. I'm like, I'm really curious, because that's one thing. I would love to become the first drone pilot in the nation, if not the world, that is legally blind and flies drones with aerial photography. That would be one of my key things I would love to do.
Well, that would be pretty cool. I mean, I know nothing about drones. I've never flown one. I'd love to. I think that'd be fun to do. But the photography I do is when I go on some kind of expedition, and especially one that I think I might be writing about. You know, I take a point and shoot camera and take a lot of photographs along the way, and then try to integrate the photos with whatever I'm writing. And so I used to write articles regularly, and so that's how the photos I've had published have all been associated with the articles.
Okay, perfect. And good to know to start writing articles and all that stuff. Okay, fair enough. Perfect. Thank you so very much, and I'll send you the campaign information over. I appreciate all your time, and anything that you could do, I also appreciate. I appreciate it very wholeheartedly.
Well, okay. Well, we'll see what Melissa has to say, and then at least maybe the two of you can be connected.
Perfect. Sounds good. I think, believe it or not, I think I might have met Melissa, because I'm part of the National Federation of the Blind, and I work for Florida Reading Vision Technology. So we might have maybe crossed paths very quickly in some conference. I'm like, the blind community is so big that people cross paths all the time. That doesn't mean that you know the person. And the reason why I don't know her intimately is because I'm not a dog user. I'm not a guide dog user. That's why I don't know her. I think I've heard of her name.
Well, that's her, one of her passions is service dogs. And She's Mexican American, so she's lived in the U.S. All her life, but she does. I mean, she does have a bit of an accent. So if you wouldn't necessarily connect her voice with her name, because you know Hudson is a WASP name. That's her husband's name. She's married. My actual blood cousin is her husband, David Hudson.
David Hudson, okay.
Mm-hmm. And he's
I know Hudson, and he is the director of the Center for Independent. I mean, he's the director of the Florida Center for the Blind here in Florida. Ed Hudson.
Well, that wouldn't be any relation of ours.
Okay.
So all the Hudsons in that are my cousins all live in California.
Fair enough. I understand. Perfect.
Well, I'll look forward to getting your email, and you take care. Good talking with you.
Thank you. You too. Take care. Bye-bye.